I'm Andy Taylor, and you're listening to Inside the U.S. Open.
Coming up on Inside the U.S. Open.
What surprised me is it's not as easy as I thought it was going to be. It's more work, and you got to do a little more research, and also it's not simple just to go have those conversations you have in meetings. You have to explain yourself.
And does Bobby Jr. play some tennis too?
Bobby Jr. does it all. Bobby, you a tennis player?
He's doing a little karate.
He's doing some karate
against the wall. He thinks he's a ninja right now, but I'll get him into it.
The closer we can bring you at home onto the court and into the game, we feel like you'll become a fan for life and continue to come back. So I think for us, it's just continuing to grow the content opportunities that we have here across any platform, because TV is more than just the big screen TV. It's how do we get into your phone and onto your iPad, into your computer, and outside of the 2 weeks of the U.S. Open.
Hi, everyone. It's Nick McCarville, and it's episode 5 of Inside the U.S. Open. On this episode, we're diving into the TV world to show you how the tennis makes it to your TV sets at home. And first to talk us through that process is James Blake. He's a name that you recognize, a former world number 4. And first off, he's telling us about his transition from player to commentator and the challenges that the TV booth offers him in that role. Then we take a little bit of a break from the TV theme and talk to one of the stalwart teams in men's doubles history, the Bryan brothers. They're playing in their 23rd U.S. Open. That's right, they made their debut in 1995, and we talked to them about their favorite tournament of the year and the challenges that the U.S. Open offers. Lastly, we've got Danielle Cranin. She's a TV broadcast manager right here for the USTA, and she oversees all of the international broadcasters, including ESPN, which I know a lot of you are watching the tennis on, and how all of that works, getting the tennis from the courts right to your TV sets at home. But first, let's talk to James Blake. James Blake, busy guy. Tell me, walk me through what a normal U.S. Open is for you this year, because you've got the TV duties now at Tennis Channel.
Yeah, so I'm getting up pretty early, which I guess isn't as shocking to my system anymore now that I got two little kids that wake me up early at home. But getting up early, and there's an 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. sort of pregame show on the Tennis Channel. It's called Tennis Channel Live. And so I'm a part of that every morning. And then there's a show at night called The Daily Show that we tape during the day as well. So it's been fun being a part of those and get to just talk tennis with some other great tennis minds, Paul Anacone, John Wertheim, Justin Gimelstob, Brett Haber, Steve Weissman, Martina, Lindsay Davenport. So we have a great time doing that. And just some of our meetings are just as fun as anything else, because we're just talking tennis and figuring out what we're going to say on the air. And it's been fun. And then I'm usually done by middle of the afternoon and then end up doing some other corporate things or spending some time seeing some of the, I've gone out and watched a few of the matches, seeing some of the players I've become close with and gotten to know well. So it's been relatively busy. I've stuck around for the foundation, for my foundation events, for USTA foundation events, and keep me on my toes.
Yeah, absolutely. So now for you doing the TV stuff, we'll get to a lot of other things here in a couple minutes, but what's been the biggest challenge? Because now you've gotten your feet wet, I think, a little bit with the Tennis Channel stuff, but what surprised you, or what have you had to learn in that role?
Well, what surprised me is it's not as easy as I thought it was going to be. It's more work, and you got to do a little more research, and also it's not simple just to go have those conversations you have in meetings. You have to explain yourself, because you're not just talking to Andy Roddick or someone that you're talking to in the locker room that knows everything that you're talking about. You got to explain yourself a little more thoroughly, and you can't take for granted what the viewer may or may not know. So that's been interesting. And I just feel like it's similar to a lot of things, is the more you practice, the more reps you get in, the better you're going to get at it. So I'm already shocked at a year later, how much more comfortable I do feel, and hopefully how much more comfortable I'm getting, and I will continue to get better and better. I see people like Justin Gimelstob, like Jim Courier, that have been doing this for years, and how professional they are when they're on the air, and all the research they've done, and it makes a big difference. And I'm learning that, and I'm continuing to improve.
Is that the one thing, you know, that people watch TV, obviously at home, watch the U.S. Open, watch Tennis Channel. Is that the one thing you think the research that they'd be the most surprised by, or what's the one aspect that surprised you the most?
Yeah, I think they'd be amazed to know how much goes into one match, to calling one match. It's not really possible to just show up and sit there and watch the match like you would at home on your living room. If I'm going to sit and watch a match, you know, a Roger Federer match, a Rafa Nadal match, I'm just going to sit at home and watch it. I can turn it on 2 minutes before it starts, but for calling the match, you need to know a ton of stuff that may come up during the match. Their records on clay, their records on hard, their records against each other, their records, you know, a lot of other things, how they've done recently, what they've done at this event in the past. And a lot of it goes unused. You know, it just doesn't come up in the course of the conversation of the match. And the other thing about calling matches is how much you have to pay attention to the flow of the match. You can't just start a story when it's 40-30 at one all, because there might be a break right coming up right away, and how maybe later in the match you have to let the crowd speak for itself. You have to let the crowd really carry you through to the end of the match of a 7-6 in the third match or something like that. So just a lot of little things that you learn about calling matches and then being on the shows, you know, when to talk, how much to say, how much not to say. How much not to say is really important. As I ramble on through this answer, when I'm on the air, I have to know not to do those kind of things.
Well, that's the thing you're saying. You know, obviously practice is what's going to help you the most, but do you have producers or people in your personal life that are helping you, saying, hey, James, that was crap today, or listen, you're doing this well? I mean, how do you improve in that sense?
Yeah, I've been really lucky to have some great producers. Ross Schneiderman, Mark Huska, and a few others that have been great with just getting in my ear immediately and saying, hey, that was good energy. That one, you need to pick this up a little bit more. Because that's something else I've had to learn, is I'm a pretty laid back, relaxed person by nature. So to show the excitement, I have to almost get out of my comfort zone. So that's something that I get a comment on a lot. And I've been lucky enough to have some producers that have been in the business for a long time that are willing to criticize and willing to let me know what I'm doing is right, what I'm doing is wrong. And that's important. And I've been very fortunate.
What about otherwise for you here at the US Open? Obviously busy with the foundation stuff. As you mentioned, you also have a book that just came out. I'm guessing that there's not a lot of sleeping happening for you these couple weeks.
No, there hasn't been a lot of free time. I don't particularly see a lot of free time coming up either. Did like a little bit of a tour a few weeks ago for it, and it's been a lot of fun to be a part of that. It's a book that, in my opinion, will hopefully have a pretty lasting effect. Hopefully a little bit of a legacy where it talks about athletes that become activists, athletes that want to make a difference and have a social conscience, and how many really do want to make a positive change in the world, as opposed to all the negative headlines you see about athletes. And I was lucky enough to interview some other tennis players. It's got a feel for a lot of athletes, but since tennis is obviously my best known sport, I got to interview Billie Jean King, Martina Navratilova, and speak to them about their influences in the game and how much of an effect they've had on aspects outside of the game of tennis and really into society at large.
And James, for you, just coming back to the US Open every year, I mean, obviously you've done it now for a couple years as a retired player, but does it evoke these emotions or memories? I mean, you had some classic matches here that you played, one in particular that a lot of people remember, but what's the general feel now that you've moved on to this different phase of your career?
It's really awesome. It's a ton of fun to come back. And it's for me, I feel great about the fact that I do have those memories, and they'll always be special in my heart and my mind. But I love the fact that this place continues to get better, continues to improve, and it continues to have a life of its own. And this whole arena, the whole Billie Jean King National Tennis Center, has a feel that's greater than one player. It's greater than any current player, any past player. And I love the fact that it's named after Billie Jean King for the whole tennis center and Arthur Ashe for the biggest stadium, because they're two of the most monumental pillars of our sport. Even if they're not the greatest players that ever set foot on these grounds, they had the most impact outside of the game. So I think it's an honor to be a part of that, and I love coming here for that reason. And yeah, it brings back some nostalgic memories, and I'm thrilled about that. But I know there's a far, far away, and every time I think about the positive memories here, I also think about the hard work that it took to get there. And I know I'm far, far from that nowadays. So it's fun to just look back and know that I could do this, what these guys are out there doing now at one point, but I'm far from doing it now.
We're asking a lot of fans about what is special to them about the U.S. Open. I mean, for you guys on tour when you were playing, what did sort of the different feel of the U.S. Open compared to the other tournaments, the Grand Slams, but all the other events on tour?
Yeah, well, the night matches are something that are incredible. As we're sitting here, the night matches are going to start pretty soon, and it was just so unique because you're sitting in the locker room and it's just you in there, you and your opponent. It feels like a final every time you're stepping onto the court for a night match. And then you get out there in the crowd, the atmosphere is amazing. They're there just to see you. They're not there for any of the outer courts. They're there to see you play, and they're there for you to put on a show. And I have such fond memories of those night matches. And people, it gets late, it's midnight, it's after midnight, and people are still there. They're still excited. You know, they have work in the morning and they don't care. They're there. They're having so much fun. And you know, that's so tough to do, to get New Yorkers that excited. And so that just always had a different feel than any other event, to get New Yorkers excited, having a great time, and getting to see a night match. And usually they're pretty high level and high energy matches, so those are always have special memories for me.
And lastly, James, are you trying to craft some sort of style on air? How do you sort of get out your own persona in the limited time that you guys have, both, you know, face and voice on the screen?
Yeah, I don't necessarily try to, just the same as when I played, I'm not trying to craft anything to be like anyone else, or I try to just be myself and get my own style out there. And for me, the biggest thing I try to do is I try to be as positive as I can be. You know, there's room for criticism with just about any player, but there's also a lot of times a reason to think of it from the positive perspective. And if someone's playing poorly, a lot of times it has to do with his opponent doing something that's making them play poorly. So you got to focus on that sometimes and let people know just how difficult the game is, because I'm at least recent enough to know how good these guys are. And I hope I never get into that point of the sort of crusty, older, you know, veteran that says, oh, well, I used to be able to do it better, or in my day it was tougher. But I just want to show that this game continues to improve, and these guys are such incredible athletes mentally and physically, that I want to highlight that and let people know that if this looks easy, it's by no means anywhere close to easy what these guys are doing out there.
All right, well, good luck with those early mornings too for the Tennis Channel Show.
All right, thanks a lot.
Thanks to James Blake for taking the time to speak with us. He's doing obviously a lot of talking on TV, and from what I've watched, he's doing a pretty good job. Now, we got a chance to sit down with Bob and Mike Bryan. We wanted to talk to them in an intimate setting, and we got that. Here's Bob and Mike talking about nearing the age of 40 and still being top-level professional tennis players.
It's just crazy to talk to, you know, people that are 30 years old who were ball kids for us. That's what blows my mind, is that our career has gone so long that we've spanned a couple generation of tennis fans. And you know, kids that are college players, you know, were barely born when we started on the tour. And you know, it's been a whirlwind for us, and it's gone so quick. So you know, we don't realize that we've played for so many people around the world. We're very grateful for it. But yeah, I mean, it's been a great run, and we're turning 40. Can't believe it. People encourage us to keep going. You know, a lot of people still support us, and we're grateful for that as well. So we'll just keep giving it hell.
Well, we're also hanging out with Bobby Jr., who is, how old is he now?
Bobby, how old are you?
3
years old. So that's changed for you guys too. I mean, you both have families, you both have wives, but what's different about the tennis that you're playing, say, 10 years ago? What you guys have to do not only to win matches, but to prepare and to play your best on court?
Yeah, I mean, I think now being up there in age, we're doing more time off the court, recovering, a little bit more time in the gym. We hired a full-time trainer. I think that's the biggest thing. You can't just play a match, jump in a car, go home and feel great the next day. It takes a little bit longer to recover, and you feel it. You feel the aches and pains a little bit. And balancing the family, Bob's doing a great job. He brings his kids and his wife, and he's got his nanny, and I don't know how he does it. I mean, he's got his boy right here. He's got another one-year-old outside, a five-year-old running around. And he's super dad, so hats off to this guy. I mean,
thanks, buddy.
He only gets 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night. And
that's all I need.
And does Bobby Jr. play some tennis, too?
Bobby Jr. does it all. Bobby, you tennis player?
He's doing a little karate.
He's doing some karate
against the wall.
He thinks he's a ninja right now, but I'll get him into it.
You guys have obviously a lot of U.S. Open success to sort of cherry pick, and we were just chatting with some reporters here, and you picked out 2005 as a big moment. But what I was curious about that 2014 moment, and if people don't know it well, is your 100th title that you won here. Yeah. And obviously not just at the U.S. Open, but in your career. I guess how do you sort of put into words these sort of achievements? Now you're up to 114 career titles, and sort of encompass all of what you've accomplished, not only at the U.S. Open but overall.
I mean, yeah, we were looking at that that number 100 for a few years, and we got lucky to win 99 in Cincy the week before to give us an opportunity to do it here. And the media kind of got wind of it and started talking about it after every match, and it was in the front of our minds. I was just proud of how we stepped up and dealt with, you know, that pressure and that number and the milestone, and played some of our best tennis. It was a big relief. It was an amazing moment for us, and it was just a number that we couldn't believe, you know, because it's surreal. You know, the Woodies had 61, and that looked like an incredible mountain to climb. You know, and then we just started piling them on, and I don't know how we got there, but we're still trying to tack them on. They're not coming as quick as they used to, but, you know, we're at 114. We'd love to get 115 here. But, yeah, that's our best U.S. Open moment. But there's been a lot of fun ones here.
I mean, obviously you guys are still on tour close to full time and pushing your bodies, I think, probably as hard as you can. A big family for you, Bob, and managing that. But how's life changed outside of the court, just in general, for you guys? I mean, are there certain projects or things that you're taking on now that you're excited about, say, down the road when you do decide to step away from tennis?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the priorities have shifted a little bit. Bob is family first, and we're trying to get more time at home. We're really devoted to our foundation now. We're doing a big event with Jack Nicklaus, which we're really proud about. It's December 3rd and 4th, a tennis and golf event back-to-back.
Jack Nicklaus loved I mean, he has a grass court at his house, right?
He has three grass courts at his house. They're immaculate. Yeah, the Wimbledon groundskeepers. They're lit right on the water.
Have you guys played on them?
Of course. I've played with them. A few times I've won his tournament with him.
Really?
He does a holiday tournament, another tournament in the spring. So he's a great guy, big fan of tennis, yeah. And we've just combined forces to do a fun charity event, an exclusive 24 people, tennis one day, golf. He's got all his friends playing, you know, big names in golf, and we're going to get some big name tennis players.
Is there opportunity, do you think, to cross over more between tennis and golf? I mean, I think we pair them together sports wise, just in general, but they don't necessarily, we don't have those combined events between the two sports very much.
No, I mean, tennis players love to play golf, and golfers actually love to play tennis. You see Marty Fish, he played a lot of golf growing up, and he's a hell of a golfer. I know Nadal plays a lot, and all these guys love it. So, yeah, I mean, you look at Daniel Berger, the son of Jay Berger, former player, and you know he's one of the best golfers in the world. That's going to be a fun time to hang out with all those top guys. Jack's already got Rory McIlroy, Ricky Fowler, Dustin Johnson. He's got the best golfers lined up. So it'll be a fun 2 days down there.
And tell people how they can get information on that coming up. Or that's exclusive, is that right?
It's exclusive.
How can we get more information on your foundation in general?
On our website, brianbros.com. But, it's an invite-only event, only 24 people. And it's close to sold out. We're excited because, you know, we've been doing our foundation since 2008. Andre Agassi inspired us to start our foundation. And he actually did our first event, which was amazing. But this is going to be taking it to another level. So we're excited.
Who's the best golf? We did a media thing a couple years ago. I went golfing. I didn't golf. I trailed along with Rafa, and he is a serious golfer, right? Who's the best on tour?
Well, obviously it was Marty Fish. He's semi-pro. Yeah. He could have gone pro in golf. He chose tennis. But there's another kid, Will Blumberg. Mm-hmm. He played the qualies here, made the finals at NCAAs. He's a scratch golfer. I played with him a couple days ago. Really talented. Tim Henman, I remember, was very good. Scott Draper went pro in golf.
Great. You're playing a lot.
I'm playing a little bit. I got a couple memberships down in South Florida.
Cool.
And I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just lastly, I mean, when you guys do decide to step away, what how do you encompass? I was asking these guys on court, we were just on court a few minutes ago, but how do you encompass what the U.S. Open has meant to you? Because I think it's been such a jewel in what's been a very decorated career for you guys.
Yeah, I think it's probably, looking back on our career, it'll be our favorite tournament. Coming here, playing at 17, it just meant everything. Winning Kalamazoo and coming in here at 120 pounds and picking up our badge and going out to the practice courts and get kicked off. I remember, was it Kelly Jones kicked us off? They just didn't believe we were players. Yeah. But
we're 17 in 1995.
Yes. We're 17 and we were in the big show at that age, and it was first time in the big city. And I remember we watched the matches all day, and then we played Galbraith and Connell, the number 3 seed, and just got drilled. They won the first set 6-0 in about 6 minutes, and they're up 3-0, but right. we scraped four games.
We played on a Thursday, and Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we'd practice in the morning, and we'd watch 12 hours of tennis in the sun. We'd just go around almost getting autographed. We were such fans of it. We'd go watch the Jensens. We were just on every court. By the time we got out to our match, we were wiped out. So we do it a little different today. These days, but much fun.
Then the next year, we got another wild card, got a couple of wild cards in college. No one knows, but we actually lost in the U.S. Open first round 5 years in a row until we won our first round, then made the quarters. It's been a thrill to play here for 23 years. It's amazing. It's getting bigger and better every year. Just walking the grounds and seeing these huge stadiums, and the new Louis Armstrong is going to be epic. You know, it's going to have a roof, and this Arthur Ashe Stadium is larger than life. I mean, I've gone to the top of that thing. You can't even see the ball. You're in a space shuttle. I mean, it's so cool. And I think the fans are getting the experience here. I mean, there's nothing like it playing in New York. Right now, I think this is the slam to beat, tops them all.
Right. I think a lot of people would say there's no doubles team like you guys. So thanks for chatting with us.
Thanks, Nick.
Appreciate it.
Thanks to Bob and Mike for taking time with us on Inside the U.S. Open. Finally, we get the chance to talk to Danielle Cranin, and she oversees all of the international broadcasters, and she tells us first about what exactly her job entails.
Our international partners come with multiple crews, right? So our friends at Eurosport had do their coverage in multiple languages, Spanish, English, French, German. They have a digital group. So my team oversees all of our international partners in helping them acquire the content that they need to tell their stories back home in their countries. We do all post-match on-court interview facilitation with our partners. We help them get the stories they need, whether it's interviewing ball people, umpires, tournament officials, getting the stats and figures that they need to tell their stories the best way possible. And basically anything that they need here on site, we're here to make their experience in New York as super as possible.
Okay, now quantify it for me a little bit, because a lot of people at home, of course, in the U.S., they're watching on ESPN, right? But, of course, ESPN is the biggest broadcaster. But, in essence, there's a lot of other, you mentioned Eurosport, there's a lot of other broadcasters that are here because they want to cover the tournament globally.
Sure. So ESPN, obviously, as you just said, domestic. So then there's also ESPN International. So they are in Canada in both English and French. They are in Spanish and multiple languages in Central America, South America. They're in English in Australia, New Zealand, and the Oceania area. So that's just the family of ESPN. We go over to Europe. Eurosport is in 54 different countries over in Europe. They also have a handful of sub-licensees, so we'll get, individual broadcasters such as SRGSSR, which is Swiss. We'll get Danish, Dutch, Austrian, German individual broadcasters that come over, so we have them as one-offs. We have Super Tennis, Super Sport, which is in Africa, Star India, Fox Asia, I'm trying to go through the whole gamut of CCTV in China, Tencent in China. Wow, how could I forget our Japanese? Oh my goodness, they are one of the most fun broadcasters to deal with. They love being here. Feel badly that Kei Nishikori isn't here for them, but they've had a handful of success stories so far in singles and doubles. And of course, they focus on wheelchair. And we are excited this year to produce a number of wheelchair matches for them, provide commentary, provide graphics, provide signals that they can send back to Japan, because their wheelchair athletes are so incredible. So we're happy. We're happy to do that for them this year.
I mean, my mouth, I know this world a little bit, but my mouth is agape just at the numbers and you spitting out these different letters and all the different countries that it goes to. Now, the one thing I love about what you guys do is you mentioned it in explaining your job specifically, but there's these backstories because everyone gets to watch the tennis. Everyone's watching the tennis at home. But what we've been trying to do on this podcast is tell some of those stories behind the scenes. But for TV to do that, they've got to get help from the USTA, from the tournament to, well, what about a ball person? Or what about this, you know, veteran who's coming back and helping us in this way? And you guys are doing a lot of coordination to bring those stories because you can't just have dozens or hundreds of people running around with cameras all over the US Open.
No, we try not to do that. We try not to have dozens and dozens of cameras running around the US Open. But we do. We like to provide as much access as possible. And that's where our team can, you know, we really learn about what stories they want to tell, where do they want to go. And I think, I believe, we're the one major where we make access the most easily accessible than any other event, right? So if a partner really wants to show that they're on court before a match and they're doing a stand-up, if you will, so they're showing the scene set and they want to be on court to do that, we try to find ways to make that possible for them so that they feel that they're getting the most out of their experience here in New York. Their fans feel like their partner, their TV station is embedded in the US Open and they have the inside scoop. And where possible, we can do that. And then where we can't, you know, we do produce an integrated world feed that goes to over 200 countries. And we are, you know, the USTA produces a super signal, so we act as the ESPN or the tennis channel of the world, right? So we follow the best tennis day in, all day, start to finish, first ball to last, across all 12 TV courts to start the tournament. We get down to, today we're down to three. Actually, we're down to five, but we have announcers on three. So we provide them, hey, look, if you want to do your own production, great. If you want our production, we're happy to produce for you, and you can use our world feed to tell the story back in your country. And we're here to help provide their crews the best access. You know, if they want to talk to David Brewer, we'll sit down and see if David will give him an interview. If they want to talk to to Brian Early, our tournament referee, we're happy to do that as well. They want to talk to the architect who is designing the brand new Louis Armstrong, we'll make that happen. You know, we like to say anything is possible with a little time and planning. So if they get us their request, we're going to find a way to get it done.
Now, if you want to talk about this, we can, but we were texting before you came over and you were just setting up a pretty cool meet and greet for one of the broadcasters.
Yeah, I really hope it happens. So there is a young tennis fan who, you know, he's a cancer survivor. He's 10 years old. He chose to amputate his ankle and lower part of his leg. And for him, you know, he the decision of do I amputate and learn how to work with this new challenge in my life. I won't call it a disability, but this new challenge, or do I fight cancer and have continual operations on my leg because it's right on where the cancer was located. Long story short, this kid is great. He chose to amputate his leg. His icon is Roger Federer, like, of course, all of us. And Roger sent him some signed, you know, memorabilia for him while he was in the hospital recovering. He's playing tennis, and tennis for him was sort of his way to get through all of this. He's like, I want to get back out on the court. I want to play tennis again. He went to this great institute to find a working leg apparatus that can turn. You know, most prosthetics, you know, it's binary. It's one way. You know, you can walk normally, but the side-to-side movement that you get in tennis is difficult. Anyway, he's going to be hitting today on court with Paul Anacone from Tennis Channel. And I believe that Paul is setting up a meet and greet with Roger. So, you know, here's one small little bit, you know, where we have connections through players and agents and broadcasters and coaches that, you know, here's a kid who overcome long odds and might get the chance to meet Roger today. So that's why I was delayed in getting here to you.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Now, so tell me what's been, I mean, because you've been here for several years now, and tell me one or two things that have happened successfully that you've been really proud of, or I know that you guys have tried to grow sort of the access of broadcasters for what they can show their fans at home, because in the social media world, in the world that I often exist in, it's about behind the scenes. And TV was once, I think, a very sort of like, stayed and staged beast, and now it's become much more what can we show people that makes them feel like, as we're doing right now, sitting at the U.S. Open?
I think one of the biggest success stories we've had is recognizing that television and media and social media, it's more than just the big screen TV you have in your living room, right? It's the best available screen. You can put content on any platform. And being nimble enough and advanced enough to say, if someone wants to capture practice on their phone and use Facebook or use social media as the device that they're getting that message back to their fans and their country, like, we'll find a way to do that. Yes, there's contracts and rights and things, hoops that you have to jump through, but I think for my team, we've grown from a handful of people working on the U.S. Open to over 100 that we contract and bring in and work on this event, just from a TV perspective to make this all work. You know, we've gone from 5 TV courts to 12. Next year, we hope to be on all courts with a TV signal. We went from signing off air on our world feed, a day session and night session, to being continually first ball to last ball coverage, so nearly 160 hours of tennis over the 2 weeks. Next year, we're looking at producing all 4 days of qualifying. We're getting innovative. You know, last year, we tried an in-match interview with a player. We hope to continue to start pushing the boundaries there, where fans want access to the players. Our broadcast wants access to the players to increase that fan avidity. So for us, the closer we can bring you at home onto the court and into the game, we feel like you'll become a fan for life and continue to come back. So I think for us, it's just continuing to grow the content opportunities that we have here across any platform, because TV is more than just the big screen TV. It's how do we get into your phone and onto your iPad, into your computer, and outside of the 2 weeks of the U.S. Open.
Well, and that's what I kind of wanted to close up with you, is sort of bridging that gap between TV and the internet, or, you know, online, because there's no difference now. I mean, the way that you guys explain a little bit about streaming and what you guys have tried to do on that platform, and then, you know, each broadcaster, I think, has its own setup or deal as far as what they can stream and what ends up online. But no longer are people just sitting in front of their quote-unquote TV. There's so much more to be offered, and you have literally a full-time job that you work 49 weeks of the year outside of the U.S. Open. I just gave you 1 week of vacation. Maybe you get more, but no. I don't think you do.
No, I don't. Actually, I have no vacation. None whatsoever.
Give her a holiday after the U.S. Open, right?
Yes, after the U.S. Open. Monday, I'm done. I'm going to be, you know, on a beach somewhere with a cocktail. It's interesting to see, like, where television is going. You know, again, we don't view TV anymore as just TV. So all of our matches that we produce are available in the States here on ESPN3 as part of the Watch ESPN platform. So that's nearly 1,300 hours of television when you count up the number of courts and the number of hours that we do each day. That's a lot of television. So, you know, if you have a specific court or a specific player that you want to follow, you know, it's available to you. And that's on your phone, that's on your tablet, it's online. I know Eurosport has their own player, so they have their own digital player that they make available in their territories. And again, they're literally taking every court that we produce. So they're doing that in the number of languages that they have over there. So they can get hyper local in their markets and say, okay, I'm going to do this in German, I'm going to do this in French, I'll do this in English. Or they can just sit on our world feed and put that out on their player, you know, and do it that way. ESPN, through their partnership with DirecTV, they make basically a red zone and a Sunday ticket, if you will, of tennis for the first 7 days of the event. So you can go on DirecTV and get 5 different courts available to you on television through that offering. So, you know, we don't see it as cannibalization. We see it as how can we put content in as many places as possible, because we know that people are going to consume the content how they want to. We can't dictate to them, here's how you should watch tennis. We're just going to make it available as many places as possible so that you can watch it how you want to watch it.
All right. Well, from the fans at home to you, Danielle Cranin, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, Nick. Happy to be here.
Well, thanks to Danielle, and thanks to everyone who joined us on Inside the U.S. Open for this episode. James Blake, the Bryan brothers, and Miss Cranin herself. You, of course, can find the podcast on Audio Boom or on Apple Podcasts, or go to usopen.org, click on the social section, and we're right there for you. We're heading towards the final weekend of the U.S. Open, and we're going to give you more behind-the-scenes action right here on Inside the U.S. Open. Thanks for joining us, and I'll talk to you again soon.